The prince had always taken care that the first dinner at Donna Fugata should bear the stamp of solemnity. French wines were served, and the servants were in powder and knee breeches. On just one detail did he compromise. He never wore evening dress, lest he embarrass guests who would obviously possess none. That evening, the family were awaiting the last arrivals. Francesco, the prince's 16-year-old son, burst into the room and announced, "Papa, Don Calogero is just coming up the stairs, in tails." Tancredi, intent on charming the wife of Don Onofrio, realized the import of the news a second before the others and burst into laughter. No laugh, though, came from the prince, on whom this news had almost more effect than the bulletin about Garibaldi's landing at Marsala. That had been an event not only foreseen, but also distant and invisible. Now he saw revolution in the white tie and two black tails moving up the stairs of his own home. Not only was he, the prince, no longer the major landowner in Donna Fugata, but he now found himself forced to receive, when in afternoon dress himself, a guest in evening clothes. When he moved towards the door, however, his agonies were somewhat eased. Though perfectly adequate as a political demonstration, it was obvious that, sartorially, Don Calogero's tailcoat was a disastrous failure. The cloth was excellent, but the cut appalling. The wings of his cravat pointed straight to heaven, his huge collar was shapeless, and it is our painful but necessary duty to add that the mayor's feet were shod in buttoned boots. Don Calogero advanced towards the princess with a hand outstretched and still gloved.
"My daughter begs you to excuse her. She was not quite ready, but she'll be here in a second."
The second lasted 5 minutes. Then the door opened, and in came Angelica. The Selina family all stood there with their breath taken away. Tancredi could feel the veins pulsing in his temples. She was tall and well-made on an ample scale. Her skin looked as if it had the flavour of fresh cream, her childlike mouth that of strawberries. Under a mass of raven hair curling in gentle waves, her green eyes gleamed motionless as those of statues, and like them, a little cruel. She was moving slowly, and emanating from her whole person the calm of a woman sure of her own beauty. She took no notice of the prince hurrying towards her. She passed by Tancredi, grinning at her in a daydream. Before the princess's armchair, she bent her superb back in a slight bow. The princess remembered the rather ugly and uncared-for 13-year-old girl of 4 years ago, and could not make her tally with this voluptuous maiden before her.
"Angelica, my dear, it's so long since I've seen you. You've changed a lot, not for the worse."
The prince had no such memories to reorganize. Old warhorse that he was, the bugle call of feminine beauty found him ready, and he turned to the girl with the tone of gracious respect he would have used to the Duchess of Bovino or the Princess of Lampedusa.
"How lucky we are, Signorina Angelica, to have gathered such a lovely flower in our home. I hope that we shall have the pleasure of seeing you here often."
"Thank you, Prince. I see that you are as kind to me as you have always been to my dear father."
The voice was pretty, low-pitched, a little too careful, perhaps. Florentine schooling had nearly suppressed the Sicilian accent. Tancredi, after being introduced by Don Calogero and just managing to resist implanting a kiss on Angelica's hand, had resumed his chat with the Signora Rotolo without taking in a word that the good lady said. All were contented, all except Concetta. She had, of course, embraced and kissed Angelica, and told her not to use the formal third person, and insisted on the familiar tu of their infancy. But under her pale blue bodice, her heart was being torn to shreds. Beneath a smooth forehead, she found herself brooding over daydreams of poisoning. She snatched at details. Angelica's little finger in the air when her hand held her glass, a reddish mole on the skin of her neck, an attempt to remove with a finger a shred of food stuck in her very white teeth, a certain coarseness of spirit. She hoped that Tancredi would notice and be revolted by these obvious traces of difference in breeding. But Tancredi had already noticed them, and alas, with no result. He was letting himself be drawn along by the physical stimulus of a beautiful woman, and by the excitement aroused by a rich girl in the mind of a man both ambitious and poor. At the end of dinner, the conversation became general. Don Calogero told some inside stories about the conquest of the province by Garibaldi. The notary told the princess of a little house he was having built out of town. Angelica, excited by light, food, Chablis, and the obvious admiration she was arousing in every man around the table, asked Tancredi to describe the glorious battle for Palermo. She had put an elbow on the table and was leaning her cheek on her hand. Her face was flushed, and she was perilously attractive to behold. The young man described the campaign as if it had all been quite light and unimportant. "It was the greatest fun, signorina. Our biggest laugh was one night when the general needed a lookout post at the top of the convent at Origlione. We knocked, banged, cursed, knocked again. No one opened. It was an enclosed convent. Then I and one or two others tried to break down the door with our rifle butts, nothing doing. We ran to fetch a beam from a shelled house nearby, and finally, with a hellish din, the door gave way. From a corner of the passage, we heard desperate screams. A group of nuns had taken refuge in the chapel and were all crouching round the altar. They looked absurd, old and ugly in their black habits, ready and prepared for martyrdom. Tassoni, who's a card, shouted, 'Nothing doing, sisters. We've other things to think of. But we'll be back when you've some novices.' And we all laughed, fit to burst." Angelica laughed, still leaning on her elbow, and showed all her pointed teeth. Her lovely throat quivered. "What fine lads you must have been. How I wish I'd been with you." Tancredi seemed transformed, the excitement of the story mingling with the agitation produced by the girl's air of sensuality, changed him for an instant from the gentle youth he was in reality into a brutal and licentious soldier. "Had you been there, signorina, we'd have had no need to wait for novices." Angelica had heard a lot of coarse talk at home, but this was the first time, and not the last, when she found herself the object of a sexual innuendo. The novelty of it pleased her. Her laughter went up a tone, became strident. At that moment, everyone rose from the table. Tancredi bent to gather up the feather fan dropped by Angelica. As he rose to his feet, he saw Concetta, with face aflame and two little tears in the corners of her eyes.
"Tancredi, one tells nasty tales like that to a confessor, not to young ladies at table. Anyway, not when I'm there."
And she turned her back on him. Before going to bed, Don Fabrizio paused a moment on the little balcony of his dressing room. Beneath lay the shadowed garden, sunk in sleep. In the inert air, the trees seemed like fused lead. From the overhanging bell tower came an elfin hoot of owls. The sky was clear of clouds. The prince's soul reached out towards the stars, towards the intangible, the unattainable, which gives joy without laying claim to anything in return. It had been a bad day, he realized now. Don Calogero's tailcoat, Concetta's love, Tancredi's blatant infatuation, even the threatening beauty of that girl, Angelica, rubble preceding an avalanche. Bendicot, in the shadow, rubbed a big head against his knee.
You, Bendico, are a bit like the stars. Happily incomprehensible. Incapable of producing anxiety.
Tradition required that the day following their arrival, the Selina family should visit the convent of the Holy Ghost to pray at the tomb of Blessed Corbera, forebear of the prince and foundress of the convent. The convent had a rigid rule of enclosure, and entry was severely forbidden to men. That was why the prince particularly enjoyed visiting it, for he, as direct descendant of the foundress, was not excluded. And of this privilege, shared only with the King of Naples, he was both jealous and childishly proud. Entry into an enclosed convent is never a quick matter, even for one possessing the most sacred of rites. Although the visit had been announced beforehand, there was a considerable wait in the parlour. Towards the end of this, Tancredi unexpectedly asked the prince, "Uncle, can't you get me in too? After all, I'm half a Selina, and I've never been here before." But Concetta turned to her cousin with her sweetest smile. "Tancredi, we passed a beam of wood lying in front of Ginestra's house. Go and fetch it. It'll get you in all the quicker." Tancredi's blue eyes clouded, and his face went red as a poppy. He tried to say something to the surprised prince, but Concetta continued acidly now and without a smile. "He's only joking, Father. He's been in one convent already. That ought to be enough for him. It's not right for him to enter this one of ours." With a grinding of drawn bolts, the door opened. It was too late to ask questions, and Tancredi was left behind to walk up and down in front of the convent under the blazing sky. On returning to the palace, the prince went up to the library. From the great balcony could be seen the square of Donna Fugata, vast, shaded by dusty plane trees. Opposite were some houses behind prim empire fronts, among them that of Don Calogero Sedara. Don Fabrizio walked up and down the immense room, every now and again glancing out at the square. His eye was drawn to a slim, well-dressed figure. He screwed up his eyes. It was Tancredi. He had changed his clothes. He was no longer in brown, as at the convent, but in Prussian blue. My seduction colour, as he called it. In one hand he held a cane, and he was walking with cat-like tread, as if taking care not to get his shoes dusty. 10 paces behind him followed a servant, carrying a tasselled box containing a dozen yellow peaches with pink cheeks. Tancredi sidestepped a sword-waving urchin, carefully avoided a urinating mule, and reached the Sedara's door. Tancredi had been gone for more than a month and was now bivouacked at Caserta. Every now and again he sent the prince letters which the latter read with alternate frowns and smiles, then put away in the remotest drawer of his desk. The boy had never written to Concetta, though he did not forget to send her a greeting. Angelica was now visiting them almost daily, more seductive than ever. Officially, these visits were made to the girls, but in fact their climax obviously came at the moment when she asked with apparent indifference, "And what news of the prince?" Prince did not, alas, mean him, Don Fabrizio, but his nephew. This provoked a strange, somewhat disagreeable sensation in Don Fabrizio. The feeling of finding himself a prisoner in a situation evolving more rapidly than foreseen was particularly acute that morning. The night before had brought a letter from Tancredi. Dearest Uncle Fabrizio was informed that his affectionate and devoted nephew had for the last 3 months been a prey to the most violent love, and that neither the risks of war, read Walks in the Park of Caserta, nor the many attractions of a great city, read The Charms of the Dancer, Schwarzwald, had been able for an instant to drive from his mind and heart the image of the Signorina Angelica Sedara. Now he was begging his dearly beloved uncle to request Signorina Angelica's most esteemed father for her hand on his behalf. Don Fabrizio only revealed the contents of this letter to his wife when they were lying in bed under the glow from the oil lamp. Maria Stella did not say a word at first, just made a series of signs of the cross. Then she loosed the thunderbolts of her eloquence.
"I'd hoped he would marry Concetta. He's a traitor. First he betrayed his king, now he betrays us."
Don Fabrizio gave a sideways glance to assure himself that the valerian was on the night table. For a moment he thought of getting out of bed and fetching it, but he compromised by just sitting up.
"Now, Stella, my dear, don't be silly. As for Concetta, he never actually said a word to her. And he's not a traitor. He follows the times, that's all, in his politics and in his private life. He's a very lovable lad. You know that as much as I do, Stella, my dear."
5 huge fingers stroked the top of her tiny head. She was sobbing now. The fire of her rage had muted to self-pity. Don Fabrizio began to hope that he would not have to get out of the warm bed and face crossing the chilly room.
"Now let's sleep. Tomorrow I'm going out shooting with Don Ciccio. I have to get up early. What's decided is decided. Good night, Stella, my dear."
He kissed his wife and lay down again. The shadow of his recumbent form was projected on the silken walls, like the silhouette of a mountain range on a blue horizon. The joy of shooting began with shaving by candlelight in a room still dark. It was whetted by crossing sleeping drawing rooms, by passing through the motionless garden under a grey light in which the earliest birds were shaking the dew off their feathers, by gliding through the ivy-hung wicket gate, by escaping, in fact. In the street, Don Ciccio waited, smiling into his yellowed moustaches and swearing affectionately at the dogs flexing their muscles under velvety fur. Venus still glimmered, like the bloom on a grape, damp and transparent. When Don Fabrizio, Don Ciccio and the dogs reached the top of the hill, there among the tamarisks and cork trees appeared the real Sicily, undulating to the horizon in hillock after hillock, comfortless and irrational. Donna Fugata lay huddled and hidden, and not a living soul was to be seen. The only signs of the passage of man were scraggy rows of vines. Beyond the hills on one side was the indigo smudge of the sea, more mineral and barren even than the land. A slight breeze moved over all, bearing the smell of dung, carrion, and sage. The two men rested under the shadow of cork trees. They drank tepid wine from wooden bottles, ate a roast chicken from Don Fabrizio's haversack, followed by a little muffoletti, which Don Ciccio had brought with him, and local grapes, ugly to look at and delicious to eat. They began to doze off. Men might doze, but nothing could stop the ants. Up they came, disordered but resolute. Groups of 3 or 4 would stop now and again, then would take up their march with the others, their gleaming backs seeming to quiver with enthusiasm. By some association of ideas, the activity of these insects reminded the prince of the days of the recent plebiscite about unification.
"And you, Don Ciccio, how did you vote on the 21st?
Taken by surprise, the poor man hesitated, not knowing what to reply. But then he recovered his peasant astuteness.
"Excuse me, Excellency, you know that everyone in Donna Fugata voted yes."
Don Fabrizio did know this. Before the voting, many had come to him for advice. All of them had been exhorted sincerely to vote yes. Don Fabrizio could not see what else there was to do. whether it was seen as a fait accompli or a historical necessity, and considering the trouble these humble folk might get into if their negative attitude were known. He had noticed, though, that not all had been convinced by his words. Some interpreted his advice as ironical. Others went off determined to follow instead the age-old proverb about preferring a known evil to an untried good. The day of the plebiscite had been windy and grey. Late that night, the shutters on the balcony of the town hall were flung open, and the mayor appeared with a tricolour sash over his middle to announce that the plebiscite at Donna Fugata had had the following results. Voters, 515. Voting, 512. Yes, 512. No, zero. The gloom of that night still lay deep in Don Fabrizio's heart. His discomfort was not of a political nature. The major interests of the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies and of his own class had come through battered but still alive. In the circumstances, he could not expect more. No, during that brief announcement of figures, he had a feeling that something, someone, had died. God only knew in what corner of the popular conscience. Don Ciccio stood up.
I, Excellency, voted no. 100 times no. Those swine in the town hall just swallowed up my opinion and spat it out, transformed as they wanted. I said black and they made me say white. The one time when I could say what I thought, that bloodsucker Sedaro behaved as if I'd never existed, as if I never meant a thing.
At this point, Don Fabrizio knew what had been killed at Donna Fugata, at 100 other places in the course of that night. It was good faith. Just the very newborn babe who should have been cared for most. Don Ciccio's negative vote, 50 similar votes at Donna Fugata, 100,000 noes in the whole kingdom, would have had no effect on the result. But this maiming of souls would have been avoided.
Listen, Don Ciccio, what do they really think of Don Calogero at Donna Fugata?
Don Ciccio felt he had already shown his opinion of the mayor quite clearly, and he was just about to say so when into his mind came rumours he had heard about Tancredi making up to Angelica.
Well, Excellency, Don Calogero Sedara is no worse than lots of others who have come up in the last few months. He's very rich and very influential too. He's clever as the devil, and we're only seeing the start of his career. In a few months, he'll be deputy in the Turin Parliament. In a few years, when church property is put up for sale, he'll become the biggest landowner in the province. He's the new man to be. It's a pity he has to be like that, though. But the rest of his family, what are they really like? Excellency, no one has laid eyes on Don Calogero's wife for years, except me. She only leaves the house to go to early mass when it's empty. Once I got up early just to see her. I was hiding behind a confessional and couldn't see very much. But at the end of Mass, she took off her veil. Word of honour, Excellency, she was lovely as the sun. One can't blame Don Calogero for wanting to keep her away from others. But secrets come out. Servants talk. It seems Donna Bastiana can't read or write, can't even tell the time. Good for bed. And that's all.
Don Ciccio smiled. He had found a way of getting some of his own back on the mayor of Donna Fugata.
She's the daughter of one of your peasants, he went on. Pepe Giunta, he was called, so filthy and so crude that everyone called him Pepe Merda. Excuse the word, Excellency. 2 years after Don Calogero had eloped with Bastiana, they found him dead on the path to Rampinzeri, with 12 bullets in his back.
The prince reminded himself that Angelica was just a rose merely fertilized by her grandfather's nickname.
You've mentioned everything, Don Ciccio. Crude mothers and fecal grandfathers, but not the Signorina Angelica.
No doubt the young man's frequent visits to Don Calogero's home had been noticed, The thought of any possible marriage between a Falconeri and the granddaughter of Pepe Merda did not even cross the minds of these country folk. Don Ciccio, like the others, simply assumed the young man was out to seduce. So he greeted the prince's question with the amused air assumed by older men when discoursing on the follies of the young.
As to the signorina, Excellency, her eyes, her skin, her figure are all there to be seen and appreciated by anyone. Don Tancredi has understood the language they speak, I think. She has all the beauty of the mother with none of the grandfather's stink of manure, and she's intelligent too. You've seen how those few years in Florence have transformed her completely. A real lady she's become.
Don Ciccio was not sensitive to subtleties in such matters.
Oh, those eyes, those legs, that breast. No stink of manure there. Her sheets must smell like paradise.
The prince turned to Tomeo, a smile feline but friendly.
Calm yourself, my dear Don Ciccio. I have a letter from my nephew charging me to ask for Signorina Angelica's hand in matrimony on his behalf. So from now on, you will talk of her with your usual respect.
Taken by surprise, all Don Ciccio's precautions collapsed.
Excellency, a nephew of yours ought not to marry the daughter of those who have stabbed you in the back. To try to seduce her was an act of conquest. This is unconditional surrender. It's the end of the Falconeri and of the Salina, too.
The prince clenched his fists. The man was a fool. This marriage was not the end of everything. It was in the very best of traditions. It was the beginning.